The following recording was produced by the Queechy Church in Queechy, Vermont. For more information on the church, its activities, and resources, please visit us online at www.queechychurch.org.
Reading from Select Proverbs. Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. The righteousness of the blameless keeps his way straight, but the wicked falls by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the treacherous are taken captive by their lust. When the wicked dies, his hope will perish, and the expectation of wealth perishes too. The righteous is delivered from trouble, and the wicked walks into it instead. With his mouth, the godless man would destroy his neighbor, but by knowledge, the righteous are delivered. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. When the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly. A tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honors him. The wicked is overthrown through his evil doing, but the righteous finds refuge in his death. Wisdom rests in the heart of a man of understanding, but it makes itself known even in the midst of fools. Lie not in wait as a wicked man against the dwelling of the righteous. Do no violence to his home. For the righteous falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked stumble in times of calamity.
Thank you, Chad. Frequently before Sunday, Jenny will ask me, what is the sermon on? The goal being for that to be something focused and succinct. She did not ask me that this week. If she had, I might have answered something like everything, all of it. We're going to tackle it all. So in an effort to not do that, right up front, I want to suggest an image to focus what we're doing. You see, the title of the sermon is Creator Wisdom and Creature Wisdom. And there's a huge distinction between the things that we know and understand and what the Lord knows and understands. We have a subset. And I want to use the image, the illustration of a spreadsheet. You could use other sorts of planning, processing, administrative software or models. We'll talk a little bit about that. But a spreadsheet, something on which you try to capture what you think is relevant for whatever the task is. And our challenge with that is everything isn't on any spreadsheet that we use. It can't actually capture what's happening in life. In fact, it doesn't even matter how narrow your focus is going to be. The spreadsheet won't capture it all. You put all the information onto that spreadsheet, set up the formulas. I want to multiply these things. I want to divide these, add, subtract, account in all kinds of ways. But it isn't all actually there. This is a part of our human condition. That will be true into eternity. But there are also things that are happening now in life that guarantee that we simply can't model life. We can't capture it and use that information as a tool the way that we want to. And I want to suggest that Proverbs actually provokes us in this way with its incredibly powerful language. As you heard Proverbs read, you probably heard righteousness always wins. That the righteous don't suffer. And the wicked always fail. That's provocative. Forces it, is that really true? Is that naive? What's going on here? So I want to look at the powerful promises that are made to us in Proverbs. I want to look at how they are provocative to us. And then we'll try to resolve that. That's a pretty standard pattern that we do in our sermons. But that's the approach I want to take. And so let's take it from the top, looking at these powerful promises. These are incredible promises. Look at Proverbs 10, verse 2. Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. This kind of absolute statement, it's powerful. It's beautiful. It's the sort of thing you hear, you say, I hope that's true. I want that to be true. We teach our children morality in this kind of a way, when we do it explicitly, right? We're always, these things are being modeled in the way that we live, but when we are didactic, when we're intentionally teaching, we use this kind of absolute language. Do not lie. Do no violence. Do not steal. No exceptions. And this is what our society teaches all of its citizens. Comply with the rules. Observe all the administrative regulations. Don't use tax loopholes. That's unethical. Only rich people can use trust funds and offshore accounts and tax loopholes. Normal people are not allowed. No insider trading. Only members of Congress are allowed to do these things. Right? There are always exceptions. But we generally speak absolutely. And why do we do that? Because we recognize that if at least most people don't abide by these kinds of things, they don't have a strong moral code, there will be lawlessness. And then the wicked really will prevail by and large. In fact, only the wicked will prevail in that context. So there's a kind of a pragmatic reason that we don't speak pragmatically about morality. We have to speak absolutely. Because if you give an inch, the whole thing could fall apart. We have that sense. Look at Proverbs 11, verse 5. The righteousness of the blameless keeps his way straight, but the wicked falls by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the treacherous are taken captive by their lust. Now, here, these promises, they're presented as these are things that are embedded into the way the world works. No extra action is actually needed to make this true. This is the way it is. The wicked will destroy themselves. And the righteous, their righteousness will deliver them. What this tells us is that this wisdom, these promises are given to us, not limited to a particular context. The only context that we are given in Proverbs is a father speaking to his son, saying, I want you to know what real wisdom is, and I want you to know how to live, because there are only two outcomes to this life. There's blessing or there's cursing, and I want you to get the blessing. That's the only context. Everything else is up for grabs. We are told very simply that a righteous person will be delivered, that a wicked person will destroy themselves, and we should live like that's true. At the same time, Proverbs is very honest about the consequences of what wicked people do. In 11:10, when it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices, and when the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness. Because they do evil. They really do harm. And so for them to be stopped is a good thing. It's not theoretical. Well, it's a good thing the wicked never get their way. They evidently do, to such a degree that the righteous will rejoice when they fall. It doesn't. The wisdom of righteous of Proverbs, however, does not require that context. It doesn't say in a righteous society the wicked fall by their wickedness. That would make sense to us. Rather, what Proverbs says is this is just true. It doesn't matter how wicked your society is, doesn't matter how righteous your society is, how capitalist or socialist, however, whatever polls you want to set up, none of that matters for this to be true. It doesn't require any context other than God's world. This is something that we should take as universally true, and that I think is difficult for us. That's hard for us to accept and just simply say, yes, I will trust that this is true. Because we all suspect that as we try to add these things up, something's happening off the spreadsheet. Something's happening out there in reality that keeps breaking in. And so these powerful promises become to us provocative. This is the second thing I want to look at. How provocative these promises are. It provokes us to say, is this really true? If a righteous life leads to a reward and wickedness is punished, then yes, all would be well. If every thief were caught and restitution was made, if every murderer was prevented from carrying out their wicked desires, if all government and corporate corruption was rooted out, fine, I would agree. This is the way to live. This is great. But if it's not true, we all have this going on in the background, but if that's not true, then I would be the victim of the wicked. I would be the one to lose out on opportunities. I could go hungry. I could even die. Even if I agree, I don't want to be like the wicked. I don't want to do what they're doing. I don't want to take what's not mine. I don't want to oppress people just because I'm in an advantageous position. Righteousness requires more of us than just not following through on our evil desires. It actually requires that we comply with what God has said, that we trust in his words and we take them as true, that we not hedge our bets, that we not take preemptive action to stop wickedness ahead of time. It means trusting that God is really going to sort things out. Right? What this would mean is stopping the impulse that says, I bet that person's going to take advantage of me. I'll get them first. That's what I'm talking about. Not doing that otherwise seemingly wise thing. Because we are all inevitably building in our minds a model of what life is really like, what the world is. And part of that really is gaining wisdom from our experience. You do things, you find out that doesn't work, that does work, and you build up a kind of understanding, usually devoted to answering questions like, how can I live in a way that makes me happy? What's the right way to face the decisions I have where I don't know what the outcomes are going to be? Maybe I can project those outcomes and try to select the better ones. There's got to be a way to do that. Or on a bigger level, how can I create a just situation? How can we stop the wicked? How can we make the outcomes of people's actions match their character? Why can't wicked people get bad things and righteous people get good things? There's got to be a way to make this all happen. And that's why I want to suggest that image of a spreadsheet, where you're trying to capture all the information and project the outcomes and then manipulate those outcomes. That's what we're constantly trying to do. I think this is one of the great follies of our age in particular, the attempt to get everything onto the spreadsheet, to get everything into the bureaucratic approach where all the rules cover all of the bases. Our governments, universities, corporations, scientific organizations measure some things, project what they think should happen, and then attempt to manipulate the outcomes. Just think about any computer model you've ever heard of. Models for animal populations, for environmental change, models for the spread and impact of disease. Even when these kinds of models are useful, right? You try to get all the information in there to figure out what's going to happen. And the only reason you want to know what's going to happen is so you can change what's going to happen. That's the point. Even when these are useful, they're always wrong. They're always wrong. They never get 100%. Rarely do they even approach it. To some degree, they're wrong. Why? They leave things out. You can't get it all in there. They fail to anticipate real human action. They're built with faulty assumptions. They're fed bad data. Because the models are only as good as the information you put into them, which we collect. Just think about that for a minute. And the understanding in those models comes from us as well. All the assumptions, all the perspectives. They are a mirror of us. They're very useful. And they might even scale, but they share all of our problems. And the attempt to get everything in the model is real folly. Again, I am admitting these are useful things, but what I'm suggesting is this is a terrible way to live. It doesn't account for what life really is. Because one, we don't have all the information. We simply don't. We don't even come close. What we have is a subset of what God has revealed in nature. Right? That's why we really do learn from experience and engagement in the world that God has made. And the scriptures frequently point us to that. And what God has revealed in his word. In Deuteronomy 29, it says, the secret things belong to the Lord our God. You could just stop there. Like, just reckon with that. There are things he knows that you will not know. You can't know. He won't tell you and you can't figure it out. And if he did tell you, you still wouldn't figure it out. There are things you just can't know. When people asked John Calvin, how does providence work? He said, you shouldn't think too much about that. Because somebody who really wants to get into how does God operate in the world enters into a labyrinth, this is his words, a labyrinth from which no man can escape. It will break your mind. Just, you have to accept that God's in control of it all. He's like, but what about, I don't know what to tell you. Or when Luther was asked this ahead of Calvin, like, what is God doing behind the scenes? He said, that's like trying to climb up into heaven and catch God in his underwear. It's ridiculous. It's impossible. You can't do it, and if you did, it would break your mind. It wouldn't make any sense to you. Without God's perspective, then, since we don't know everything, and we can't know everything, and if we did know everything, it would be worse. We would not do good things with that knowledge. Think about an idea like the age of accountability, right? At what age does a human being become accountable morally for their actions? Which I would suggest is generally at birth. But there have been other ideas, right? Maybe when they come to adulthood or when they reach the age when they would start reading the book of Proverbs and receiving that kind of moral instruction didactically and explicitly. But the scriptures don't talk about this. They don't give us that kind of explicit information. But just imagine what would happen if they did. In the name of doing good, people would be murdered to save them from their accountability. I'm not saying you and I would do that, but you know somebody would do that. We would abuse knowledge of that kind. So we don't know and we can't know and we shouldn't know certain things. And in fact, most things. And without that, we can't make sense on our own of what's happening in the world. Without God's perspective, things won't add up, especially when we start talking about those things that are particular to this phase of God's creation and plan, injustice and suffering. Just think of Solomon in Ecclesiastes. He says, I've looked at the whole world and it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem worth it. I don't know what life is for anymore. He knew as much as anybody could have known. Or Job, the most righteous man described in Scripture before Christ. And then he suffers. And what does he say? He says, I don't understand what's happening. Something's going on off the model that I've built. It's interfering and I can't make sense of it. Just think about it. This is frequently an experience I have with spreadsheets. You put something in column A. Let's say you put God's promises to the righteous. And then you put column B, what's actually happening to the righteous. And then you add the cells in the row going across. And here's the result that I often get, because I can set up a spreadsheet in a very simple way, but I can mess it up pretty easily too, and I'll get hashtag REF exclamation point. Thank you. So some of you are better with spreadsheets, but like they can't give you a result. This is stupid. What you've put here doesn't make sense. It can't be done. And in our minds, when we try to process that, that's often what happens. This is what happened to Job. I can't. It doesn't compute. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. It's absurd. I remember when I first set out to be engaged in ministry. I wanted to be involved in campus ministry. And in order to do that, I had to ask people to partner with me, to pray and to give to be part of that ministry in order for me to serve in that way. And in order to do that, I created spreadsheets, lots of sheets within, so I could keep track. Who am I talking to? Have I already talked to them? How many messages did I leave on that machine? Oh my goodness. I should have put that on the spreadsheet. I wouldn't have left so many messages. I was trying to keep track of everything to make sure that I could hit the target, I could talk to the people I needed to, that I could do it as graciously as possible. And when I did this, taking into account the amount of money I had to raise, the number of partners I needed, and what was actually likely to happen, it was not a good result. I began to despair. This is impossible. It can't be done. I didn't grow up. Okay, so I grew up in Florida, but I wasn't in a church when I was in Florida. I didn't grow up with the connections in the background. How is this going to happen? There aren't enough people in the Upper Valley for this to work. It just none of it was adding up. I didn't match the profile of the people they usually trained, and I knew that. And yet, at the end of that first round, I actually had enough to start. And I'm going to tell you what the results actually were. The result of my inadequate efforts to network, to raise money, along with God's provision, led to 15 years of evangelism and discipleship on two college campuses. You say, that's great. God provides in ways that we don't expect. He did more than that, though. He did a great deal more than that. We don't always get to see what's going on behind the scenes, but sometimes you get a glimpse. More than that, God provided a team of people who prayed and gave so generously that many of them are continuing to do so now so that this ministry can exist. And he's provided in other ways. We exist as a partnership with another church. All of this God has provided, things that I couldn't have anticipated. They weren't on none of this was on my spreadsheet, effectively. Nor could I have anticipated what was God going to do. None of it was on my spreadsheet. We don't have the information. We simply don't. And we lack the proper understanding to build a model of the world. We have the wrong assumptions. Even the most perfect, the most perfected Christian in this life, if there is such a thing, has not been fully delivered from these heart attitude problems. The most fundamental being that we should trust in the Lord with all our hearts. That's why these promises are so provocative. We really are called to trust in Him entirely. And as long as that goes astray to any degree, we're going to lack understanding. It's just not possible. You might say, so that means I can never operate. I will never develop the capacity, the maturity, the skill, the character to operate on my own apart from God. They say, no. If you want to be happy and successful, you shouldn't ever think about that. We must depend upon Him entirely. In fact, in Deuteronomy 8, God told the people that He had given them promises and He was bringing them to pass, but it all happened in a particular way. He humbled you and let you feel hunger, and He fed you with manna, which you didn't know, right? Manna wasn't on anybody's spreadsheet. It literally means, what's it? I don't understand this. You're not meant to understand manna. You're meant to eat it. That's the point. So that He might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. This is what He drives us to. You're never going to fit everything into the model. Most of what matters isn't there. It's in God's hand. And He tells you, but if you will trust me, I will surely bring these things to pass. These promises are powerful, they're provocative, and they're painful. I mentioned at the beginning there are two things that don't fit into our models, and I argue it's because by design they can't. They in fact are meant to destroy our understanding. The understanding that we have natively, these two things are meant to destroy. They are things that God uses in His way to destroy our understanding that we might trust in Him. That is the prosperity of the wicked, injustice, and suffering, particularly innocent suffering, the suffering of the righteous. And we know this because we feel the offense when anybody tries to minimize these things. When you come into contact with these in a personal way, and somebody tries to resolve this for you with their words, I mean, we have to give grace to one another. We know why. None of us are comfortable with the tension. Is there some way to resolve it? Say, when a loved one is lost, God must have needed them. Or in experiencing suffering, God is using this for some kind of good for you. The first answer, right, God needed them, that's why they're gone, is insane. It's not true on any level. But you can understand, somebody's trying, there's got to be, there must be a reason, and I'll try to make some resolution for you. We have to be gracious to each other, realizing that kind of motive, even if the answer is insane. It makes no sense. And the second one, even when it's true, right, God is always working for the good of those who love Him, have been called according to His purpose. And He does this in all kinds of strange ways. But even when it's true, it's not sufficient. This is what Job's friend said to him when he lost everything, lost all his property, lost his children. He lost his health. They said things like, I'll paraphrase, only bad people suffer, Job. If you had no sin, you wouldn't suffer. I mean, it just makes sense. God is going to accomplish something great with this, Job. And we find out that they transgressed in saying these kinds of things. Pretending as if everything that God was doing fit into their understanding and that they could then comfort their friend with that faulty understanding. And the strange thing is, if you go and read the book of Job, you're like, oh man, I don't think I'm Job, I think I'm his friends. They make a lot of sense to me. These are things that will destroy our understanding. And what I want to do now is to look at some basic ways we try to approach this, the absoluteness of these promises and the strange way in which God will use evil in this world. One basic answer is to say that what Proverbs is telling us here is generally true, but not absolutely true. It's the way things usually work. Cheaters never prosper as a general rule, even if some cheaters do succeed wildly. Responsible living is usually a better strategy for prosperity and happiness. And I think that's true. That is true of the way the Proverbs hit us. They are generally true. They are good advice in that way. We might also say that Proverbs are partially true in the sense that they are short and pithy sayings and they don't convey everything. That's true as well. That's why we see many Proverbs addressing the same situation, coming at it from different angles. The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the treacherous are taken captive by their lust. But then we're told in 11:7 that the wicked loses his hope at death, and that the righteous finds a refuge at death in 14:32. We actually have to start pulling these things together. And what we see is the wicked do prosper for a time, but they are always in the end thwarted. And the righteous do in fact suffer for a time, but in the end they're always delivered. We have to take these things together. In Proverbs verse 15, 24:15, lie not in wait as a wicked man against the dwelling of the righteous. Do no violence to his home, for the righteous falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked stumble in times of calamity. They said the righteous are always delivered, but they might fall seven times along the way. We start putting these things together. Each one on its own is indeed partial. We might say as well, honestly, we aren't the righteous people. Why should we expect these things to apply to us? We're sinners. Why should we have the expectation that these promises are for us? To which I would say, that's true. They don't belong to us because of our righteousness, but they do in fact belong to us because Jesus received them and he gives them to those who trust in him. We should have a more secure claim on these promises than we might think. They absolutely belong to Jesus and he gives them to us. All of those, I think, are helpful in thinking about Proverbs. They talk about general patterns. They are partial on their own. And that we don't deserve this anyway, but there is something deeper that God does by bringing these kinds of evils, injustice, and suffering into our lives. We're meant to be driven to something that we can't find on our spreadsheet. No matter how large you make that sheet, no matter how many cells you add to it, rows, columns, no matter how complicated programming and modeling is, there are things we can't know, can't do, and can't deal with because we are the creature and not the creator. That distinction never gets abolished. What we are forced to do is to look beyond that understanding, beyond the model of the world, beyond the spreadsheet, to see the fulfillment of what God has promised us. In order for these promises to come true, resurrection is what is necessary. It requires a deeper healing than any of us has known or will know in this life. In order to fulfill these promises that God makes, he will have to literally recreate the entire context, heaven, earth, us, all of it, every bit of it, even our bodies. He'll have to make us perfect body and soul in order for us to inherit the promises. And he will. This is what he has promised to us most fundamentally, and that he will do it to such a degree that we will all agree that he has done it. That our sufferings can't possibly compare to the fulfillment of his promises. That's what we're going to say in the end. We're going to say, I don't need to do the calculation anymore. I don't need to see it on the spreadsheet. I can just agree what you have done is better than anything I could have imagined. It would have broken my mind to see ahead of time. That suffering and injustice, it's not that they are, in one sense, even outweighed. Right? In Romans 8, when Paul says, I consider the sufferings of this present time not fit to be compared to the glory that is to be revealed. He's not saying, finally on your spreadsheet, the glory part will be greater than the suffering part. You'll get a positive result and say, good, I made out on that one. He's going to say, you're going to say, no, it just doesn't count anymore. None of it counts anymore. That's how glorious the fulfillment of these promises will be. Not that you'll say, I think it all adds up. You'll just say, there's no adding up. The suffering and the injustice don't count. It has all moved into the glory column. The reality is that God is at work now in the world. This isn't even just merely for the future. That's what we're looking forward to, the day in which we agree with him. None of this counted. The suffering, the injustice, it doesn't matter. Your glory is enough. It's greater. They are not fit to be compared. But right now, he is at work. Right now, he is doing things we can't anticipate, that we can't comprehend. His providence never sleeps. His miraculous power cannot be comprehended, and it cannot be contained. Not even when, as we celebrate now, not even when he took on a human body, it didn't contain him. That's not how that worked. Jesus did not fit in anyone's categories. He stayed in no one's box. He kept healing and teaching and driving out demons, and nobody could stop him. Not for a minute. Crowds would assemble to stone him to death, and they couldn't do it. People tried to stop his teaching. Demons came forward to challenge him. He just, gone. Just leave. You're done. You have no power. Not when he's present. He just kept going. He entered into the world and the darkness could not comprehend him. And finally, when the authorities decided they'd had enough, he'd raised enough of a ruckus, they couldn't deal with him anymore. He started raising people from the dead. They said, now we have more people to kill. That was their response to Lazarus. So we've got to go to the source. We have to stop him. They put him to death. Done. But death doesn't count. It doesn't count when his life is at play. I mean, frequently I will say, right, his life outweighed the death, surpassed it. And that's true. But the reality is you can't even compare them. When his life is in play, death just doesn't matter. It just doesn't count. It's over. It's done with. He doesn't fit into anyone's plans. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Mr. Beaver put it this way, speaking of Aslan, who, to be clear, is not a symbol of Jesus. He is, in the fiction of that world, Jesus incarnate as a lion in a parallel world. I will be pedantic about this sort of thing. So what he's saying this about Jesus. Is he safe? Of course he isn't safe. He's good. He's not a tame lion. He's not going to play by your rules. He's not going to play by the world's rules. In fact, even the way the scripture talks about the world, right? We'll say, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him, that anyone who put their trust in this one, the rules don't apply anymore. They pass from death into life. It just happens. He just does it. They will never perish, but have everlasting life. Well, the word there is cosmos, and it means everything that God has made, particularly humanity. But elsewhere, it will say, but friendship with the world is enmity with God. Why? Because in that case, when it talks about the world, it means the one we made with our rules and our values and our way of operating apart from him. And he doesn't care about that. He won't play by those rules. He has upended it. In fact, in the course of his ministry, Jesus said, I have come to cast fire on the earth. He was going to destroy the entire human order. And even death could not hold him. None of those rules would hold him. He will do whatever he wants. He always has. He always will. He's doing it now. And here's what he wants. To subject everything to his rule for his glory, and for the good of his people, to whom he made these promises, and he will not fail to bring them to pass. Nothing can stop him. Whatever you're going to put in the column against him, whatever's on your spreadsheet saying, I don't know how this all adds up, right? Why are we even told about Job? Because often we are Job, saying, I don't understand why I have to suffer this way. And the good news is that that is something that God, by his providence, has brought about. So that you would reach out to him, find out that the suffering and the injustice just don't count. Not when he's involved. You say, it doesn't feel that way. I know that too. We say this by faith. He's promised it'll be this way. He's able to break the rules that seem unbreakable to us. The rule that says, this suffering is so deep, nothing can touch it. Have you felt that? And then he just says, but I wrote the rules of reality. I will change them when I want to. You will be happy. In Christ, you will be happier than you could ever imagine, because he doesn't play by our rules, and nothing will stop him. Will you pray with me? Our God, how we need to know your power, your glory, your love, which indeed surpasses our understanding, which breaks every rule that we have set up, that changes the way that we see the world. Be gracious to us, Father. Our understanding is weak. You know that we are dust, barely held together, and so we live by your mercy. In Christ, we know that that is a secure place and a good place. And so we thank you for Christ. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.